Paolo Palmieri is Associate Professor of Philosophy in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Pittsburgh. He specializes in the history of philosophy of modern science and modern science itself. Now, Paolo, when people speak about the concept of reality and what constitutes reality, it's very easy to overlook how we come to define this term historically and philosophically. So before we actually move on to the concept of reality and realism in general and how that's progressed and been split off in the 20th century more sophisticatedly in terms of scientific realism and scientific anti-realism, go ahead and discuss some of the problems that actually lie dormant in the background but aren't always sufficiently raised in terms of what do we mean by reality itself and the historical meaning of the term reality and how this has been perpetuated throughout history, both in common language terms, in philosophy, and in scientific practice.
Let me say this, that it's extremely difficult for me to answer this question without questioning the meaning of the words and the categories here. One thing which I preliminarily say when that was, for example, when students ask me about this question, yes, I say something like, do you know the history of the word real? It's a very interesting history because the word real does not have a cognate word in Greek. It's not a Greek word. It's a Latin word. Unlike many philosophical words, which clearly come from Greek, real does not come from Greek. It does come from Latin, from a very simple word in Latin, which is res, which means something absolutely, apparently simple and plain vanilla, which is thing, which is very surprising.
So how has that affected what contemporary notions of the concept of reality is in the first place, and also how that might affect scientific realism? So let's take it back. Let's take it back to the history of science. You've said that the word itself, real, has no correlative meaning in Greek. It's a Latin word. So let's go back to some of the original pioneers of the scientific method in terms of epistemology and ontology, the Greeks, someone like Aristotle. Trace back how they would describe how they were tapping into reality from the practice of science itself.
That's right. So a more, I think, historically correct word would be, for example, phenomenon. So in fact, phenomenon is a word that comes from Greek. You have phenomenon, phenomena, and that comes from a Greek word and the Greek verb, and this roughly means things which manifest themselves. So the manifestation of things is phenomena, but we have added something interesting to this, generally speaking, Greek conception, which is, in fact, the idea of reality. Now, reality is really something which is deeply rooted in Christianity as a worldview which absorbed the Greek worldview and generated basically the modern worldview, which is Greco-Christian. So when you think about that, then you have to think what is a reality within generally a Greco-Christian or a Christian worldview. And we go back to the original meaning of the word res, and the being which is most real in Christianity is God. And in fact, the word real, when applied to things, what is the most real of all possible real things? Well, the answer is God. And in fact, in late medieval and early modern scientific and philosophical thinking, there is a technical expression for that, which is in Latin, of course, but which basically means the most real being, and that is God. So that's why I am always a bit skeptical about these discussions of realism and anti-realism, because they don't seem to acknowledge this historical heritage, and they seem to me historically quite naive.
Essentially, you're saying that it's very naive to make this clear-cut split between realism and anti-realism.
Right.
And would prefer to class it in initially as stages of phenomena. So the phenomena that some of the Greeks would have studied, obviously the real ultimate being and the real manifestation of reality is God itself. And that links into Christianity. Now,
that's right.
Throughout history, however, that's kind of changed, especially in modern and contemporary times. So, for example, during the Enlightenment, where the empirical scientific method really came to fruition, then that questioned notions of religion, because obviously you can't test or experiment or observe any kind of God in itself, so we should only stick to elements of reality that can be observed and tested. So is it fair to say that from the original Christian meaning of reality, during the progress of the scientific method itself throughout history, what can actually be classed as reality has changed in itself?
Yes, it has changed, and one actually should be very careful here, because I have fond memories of when I was a PhD student at University College in London, and one of my supervisors, who used to teach a course on the scientific revolution of the 17th and 18th centuries, always reminded students that all the great protagonists of the scientific revolution were devout Christians. And the question of the scientific method itself, it's a question, I think, which should be discussed, and one should recognize that it has been demonstrated that it is historically highly variable. And even if we look at the contemporary scene, actually, I think that science as it is practiced today is basically the result of the 19th century. So we are living in a time where science and the scientific method is something which was defined in the second half of the 19th century, roughly speaking. It's very difficult to trace it back before the 19th century. What comes before the 19th century is something which is strikingly different. You mentioned the Enlightenment, and the great figure of the Enlightenment which comes to mind, of course, is Newton. But our image of Newton over the last 40, 50 years has changed dramatically. We now know that Newton had very serious interests, for example, in alchemy. And we should, you know, we would be better off, I think, thinking of Newton first and foremost as a theologian and an alchemist, and also as a great mathematician.
If you'd like to talk about the pre-17th century in terms of the scientific method there and how it's changed since then, and its consequences of the study of reality in general.
Well, before the 17th century, there is science. The meaning of the word science and the category science are different. There are very different traditions. During the Renaissance, for example, there are strikingly different approaches to the natural world. And when we look back from the contemporary point of view, some of them will strike us as non-scientific because we apply a different lens from the 20th century. And some of them will look to us closer to our contemporary scientific method and practices. Let's take the example of the most famous university at the end of the 16th century in Europe was Padua, where the famous School of Medicine also was, and were also where Galileo was a professor there at the University of Padua for 18 years. And Galileo was a professor of mathematics, but mathematics at that time was at the bottom of the hierarchy of the academic disciplines. His colleagues, who were at the top of the hierarchy, were professors of natural philosophy who followed, or at least they claim they follow, the methodology of Aristotle in philosophy and natural philosophy. And for them, science was largely a kind of enterprise that had been handed down to us since antiquity. Science was a complete body of knowledge, and they were not interested in looking for new knowledge, because knowledge had been already handed down to us. For them, the scientific enterprise was a matter of reconstructing the knowledge that had been handed down to us from the Greeks, and particularly from Aristotle and the Aristotelian tradition, which is very interesting because it tells you that our idea that knowledge is progressive, that we can acquire new knowledge, do make experiments and verify things and build and keep building, is quite new, relatively new. However, their conception of knowledge was that that kind of knowledge was science. So in their concept of science, there was not a concept of progression, of acquiring new knowledge. Knowledge was had already been established, and it was a matter of preserving it, of understanding it, of explaining, and so on. So it's very interesting that this concept of knowledge as a progressive enterprise is alien to this tradition, to this school of Aristotelian natural philosophy in the late Middle Ages and early modern period.
Just to summarize some of those points there, you're saying that the practice of science itself in terms of a methodology and the consequences of science in terms of a knowledge-based product from the classical thinkers such as Aristotle didn't have an inbuilt progression into it in terms of doing new experiments and discovering new information about the world. It was more a technique to be preserved and executed in itself. And it isn't till the 17th century and thereafter that people tried to change the practice of the scientific methodology in itself to acquire new information of the world by doing empirical testing.
Yes, that's right. Something should be said about the difference between the Greeks and the late medieval and the early modern thinkers that during the Renaissance looked at the Greeks as the great philosophers. So their view was historically grounded in all the differences that modernity and Western civilization was all about. So one should distinguish between the Greeks, as we nowadays, for example, study the Greeks, from the view that the Renaissance and the early moderns had of the Greeks.
That's the history of the scientific method. And if I can, I'd like to talk about the implications on that, on the philosophy of science that kind of grew out of that in the last 100 years or so. So
yes,
and that's where we get into aspects of scientific realism and anti-realism, and that's fraught with many problems. So this idea that we can progress knowledge of the world through the scientific method has itself been questioned by anti-realists in terms of the analysis that theories about the world that were once empirically validated are no longer applicable in current scientific paradigms, even though previously they had a lot of explanatory power. And those in the anti-realist camp take that as to show that really these, and there's a lot of problems with scientific theories in general, but just from a crude analysis of the anti-realist perspective, one of their main arguments would be that you can latch these theories onto empirical data that explain these empirical data with a theory, but then this itself can change and then that theory becomes discarded, which makes you then question the current theory. And that's obviously popularized in the works of someone like Thomas Kuhn and paradigm shift. So
that's right.
How do you feel about that from a perspective of philosophy of science? What is it itself that this turn in the 17th century about expanding and progressing knowledge through the scientific method has in itself been questioned in the last 100 years or so about what these methods in themselves can actually show about reality, or whether it's just tentative?
Over the last 400 years or 500 years or so, the last four or five centuries, I think that there has been a dramatic shift which has placed science at the center of the intellectual enterprise, but a very particular kind of science which was deeply rooted in the materialist worldview, which became prominent around the middle of the 17th century. So this materialist and mechanistic worldview, which has been dominant over the last four centuries, although it has been challenged to a certain extent by the quantum revolution of the early 20th century, I think is very much still in place. And this has been the dominating worldview. Now, this has had consequences for the way we think about knowledge and science. In fact, has had, I think, very dramatic and I think very negative consequences, because it has dramatically restricted the scope of inquiry, the scope of reason. So reason, in a sense, or scientific reason, has been very progressively more and more narrowly defined as an enterprise which places matter at the center of the intellectual process of inquiry. And that, for me, has been, is clearly visible over the last 400 years or so. And the reason why I said that even the quantum revolution has not really challenged all of this is because it still is a kind of mechanics. It's a quantum mechanics, but it still is a mechanics which places matter at the center of the processes of knowledge and science.
Where the contemporary practice of the scientific method has really questioned any other kind of knowledge that isn't materialistic, that can't be empirically tested or directly observed, put that almost in the shadow.
Yes.
But then you mentioned quantum mechanics, which adds a different layer of complexity to it. And for example, if you look at the Higgs boson, that hasn't actually ever been directly observed. So that could be problematic in terms of observable entities. But I'm assuming what you mean by the mechanics of that is we don't directly observe it, but we observe its indirect consequences empirically. So that's still enough.
That's right.
To warrant it in a mechanical scientific sense, because there are many people that say, well, if you can't directly observe it, then that's a problem of science, as where some say, okay, you can't directly observe it, but you can at least observe its indirect consequences, and that's enough for a materialistic mechanical framework.
That's right. If you can adapt and adjust your concept of observation, then you can, you have resources for thinking about that. It's a matter of definition of how you want to define what counts as an observation of what counts as observable.
How do you feel about the aspect of string theory? Because to date, that can't actually be empirically tested. That can only be demonstrated by mathematical proofs and logic. How do you feel about that?
Well, speculation has always been part and parcel of the scientific and intellectual enterprise. So I don't think that there is anything significantly new there in terms of historical developments. This is the issue, look, that because we tend to have this kind of, which is inevitable, of course, privileged point of view, because we live in a particular historical time and we can't really escape this framework. So I think we tend to overemphasize some of the changes. But as soon as you recognize the historical dimension of these problems, then I think you can see that some of these changes are not all that challenging or all that significant. As I see it, science as it is today, as it is practiced today, has not really challenged the dominating worldview which was established with the Renaissance and Galileo and Newton and the scientific revolution of the 17th century. So it seems to me that we live in an interesting time, and that this time, the real problem of this time is to think how to move beyond this worldview, which I think has been too narrowly defined.
To pick up on that point, what would you like to see progress in this area? Because it's been too narrowly defined, how would you like to broaden its definition and expand on its meaning in terms of what it is to do science and to try and tap into reality? How would you like to see that expanded?
So beyond this dichotomies like realism and anti-realism and so on, but I would like to think in terms of multiple realities and in terms of ethnicity, for example, recognition that there are ethnic backgrounds which are important to understand how human beings really behave in different contexts. One field which I think is extremely interesting and extremely promising is the question, for example, the field of psychiatry. Other things which I find really interesting are questions, for example, to do with different, radically different ways of thinking, like heresy. See, at the end of the 16th century, in the early 17th century, there were different categories. What was possible to think and what was not possible and not permissible to think. I'm very crude here, so I apologize. But that roughly speaking, defined and demarcated the line. And there are people like Galileo and others, which I think were crossing back and forth that line. And that is what explains, or to a certain extent, what explains, I think, the radical shift in worldview from the Renaissance to the early modern period. It was a matter of negotiating that borderline between the orthodox and the heretic. Now, translate this into the late 20th century, early 21st century, and ask yourself the question, where is nowadays this borderline which defines what is permissible, I mean, philosophically, scientifically, and intellectually, from what is not permissible, what would be regarded as heretical. Now, where is this borderline nowadays? Certainly not within the practices of science as science is practiced today. It is elsewhere, I think. For example, I think there are bits and pieces of this question to be found with some of the great taboos of Western civilization over the last 60, 70 years. Think, for example, of the problem of substances, right? Substances. Now, this is very interesting because this is where there is the possibility of seeing the borderline between what is actually permissible and what is not permissible. The fact that science is not allowed to research into these substances, generally speaking, because these are forbidden substances, illegal substances, to the point that they are not even accessible to scientific research. This suggests to me that this is where there is one of the frontiers, because this is a demarcating line which could resemble something like in the 17th century, the line which demarcated orthodoxy from non-orthodoxies, from heresy. This is where I see potential for change and for rethinking our way of conceiving science to the point that we could start seeing the limitations of the paradigm which we have inherited since the early 17th century, and which has been the dominating paradigm in science. If we want to know what the new science of the 21st or 22nd century will look like, I think we need to go to the borderline of this paradigm and look for the demarcating lines which separate what is intellectually, scientifically, and philosophically permissible from what is not philosophically, scientifically, and intellectually permissible.
It almost sounds to me like you're applying a social constructivist approach when you talk about what constitutes multiple realities, what can be investigated by these realities, and therefore what demarcates some kind of practice from another kind of practice in terms of whether one is scientific or not. It sounds like you're speaking about a designated discourse in what constitutes scientific practice in itself. So it sounds like you're addressing the practice of science in a historical and social tradition in terms of what is constructed to be legitimate science.
Yes, that's right. There is a social dimension to science, which is certainly very important and should not be denied. And I myself have not actually done research in this direction because I was not really interested in that in the 17th century. I was more interested in other kinds of questions, but I certainly do recognize that there is an important social dimension to the phenomenon which should be emphasized and should be investigated and should be possibly integrated also in different traditions. The problem with this kind of, the problem here, it seems to me, is that we suffer because of a concept of academic disciplines. See, we have inherited this again from the 19th, largely from the 19th century. But this disciplinary divide, I think, is very pernicious. I think that another way of thinking about the science of the future, and possibly also with implication for our new ways of thinking about the reality, would be to break down the barriers and the disciplinary barriers. This is not only about transdisciplinary or cross-disciplinary. I really do think that the disciplines are a limiting factor. And the kind of research which I do, particularly, is also suffering because of these disciplinary barriers. So I'd like to think in terms of non-disciplinary thinking.
That's actually a good point. Also, what you mentioned there about taboos in general, there's a certain reason why in the current world as we stand now, you're going to get more academic social funding and also more scientific respect from society in general and your scientific community in general if you get a research grant to go and study something on black holes or string theory or particle colliders, as opposed to if you want to file in a research grant to investigate ghosts and ESP.
That's right.
And that's an interesting part about the taboo, and I think most people would agree with that, and it makes your point of how discipline set boundaries and what is acceptable scientific practice.
That's right.
And to me, that's very interesting because I don't know how much you've ever studied or read someone like Foucault or Derrida, which is more in the social sciences.
Yes.
But it sounds like you've got this social constructivist position in terms of knowledge and truth themselves are brought to the fore with discourses in themselves.
Yes, that's right.
And that perpetuates knowledge and truth. And I sympathize with that position a lot. And I know you've done that historically, which is very interesting. So I would just ask you specifically, if you could, on aspects of realism and anti-realism, because some of your positions as well could also be seen from the pragmatic school of thought from the American philosophical tradition in terms of...
Yes.
Yes, yes. Yeah, truth is essentially what works. Let's not keep too much fuss about it. This is what works in scientific practice, and we're happy to go into this. Do you ever consider more nuanced aspects of whether these scientific practices really tap into reality and truth in an ontological sense with a capital R and a capital T, or you're not particularly bothered about that? You're just happy that it works, and that when you go to a hospital or you fly on a plane, you're happy that this scientific method has proven that this works, and you're not particularly bothered about whether we're really tapping into reality? Because some anti-realists that are very aggressive to say that, okay, you can have entity realism, you can have structural realism, but at the end of the day, you're just latching on stuff to observables, and you can't ever know the world as it is in itself, so I'm going to take reality with a capital R out of this situation. A tradition very much influenced by Immanuel Kant in general. How do you feel about that? Is that something that bothers you or not? How do you feel about whether these theories and these theories that we can empirically test, whether they really do tap into reality, or whether we can just discard them at a point for something that works better?
And in my experience with experiments, because we did some reconstruction of experiments, we at one point I was curious to try and replicate some of the historical experiments in the history of science and see for myself how they look like. And that was a very interesting experience because, generally speaking, philosophers and historians of science, or philosophers in general, they don't have really access to laboratories and they don't really do practical research. So their views are very limited in this sense from this, it still goes back to the problem of the disciplinary divide. So we wanted to do something for ourselves, that we could get in touch with reality, if you like, by getting our hands dirty. The interesting thing which I would like to say about this experience is that an experiment is always a cross-section of something infinitely more complex. And then when you try and do it, you realize how much of the story is left out of the traditional or official account. What goes down into history as the historical record of that experiment or that series of experiments that have been done is generally a very simplified or sanitized kind of account. People like us who were not really interested in the experiment in the traditional sense, but more in the experiment as an object of meta-inquiry, if you like, the replication of the experiment and see what the experiment could do under certain circumstances or different circumstances, gave us a different perspective, a different understanding of the experiment, exposed clearly this interesting fact that there is so much that has been left out of the account of the experiment. And as soon as you begin to think about the experiment in a more integrative perspective, in a more holistic perspective, you realize that there is so much more to reality that you could possibly imagine. So even from that point of view, you could say something about reality which transcends what is generally reported in the traditional scientific literature, where experiments are discussed, presented, and the methods briefly commented on, and so on. And in fact, we came to the conclusion that experiments are really, really difficult to replicate. And in fact, one could say that it's almost impossible to replicate an experiment because conditions and circumstances are so dramatically different that then the very notion, which is the notion of replicability, which would seem to be at the center of this debate, that an experiment should be potentially replicable somewhere else by other people, is in fact a very problematic idea. It's very difficult because as soon as you start thinking about it, there are so many different factors and circumstances that make it almost impossible to think in terms of exact replication of an experiment. So every experiment seems to be a unique event in history.
Some of those challenging aspects of the being able to replicate scientific tests, to a certain extent, that tries to be smoothed over by research scientists in terms of just trying to apply as much statistical analysis to your actual data that you've got right there. But then that doesn't relieve the problem of actually trying to replicate it. So when you, in the context that you put it in, it's obviously very problematic for scientific knowledge in general. If that is one of the defining criteria of a scientific test, is to be able to replicate it. And if that's problematic.
Yes, exactly. And you would be surprised to see how few, if any at all, experiments are ever replicated. They don't replicate experiments because they are not interested in replicating experiments, because you don't make a career in replicating somebody else's experiments. I think that for me, if there is something clear that has been a lesson that we should learn from the early 20th century, which the first three or four decades of the 20th century, which I think were the most creative in all possible, in all fields, not only science, but literature, art, and so on, I think that there is obviously the lesson that this 400 years old paradigm, which we have inherited from the 17th century, is very narrow, is something that has come to a point that is restricting the scope of inquiry and restricting our notion of reason, our notion of what counts as philosophical or intellectual enterprise and inquiry. And I think that the horizon clearly indicates that to move beyond this framework, beyond this materialistic and mechanistic framework, is the challenge which is ahead of us.